This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents The White Rose, written by Glenn Cook and narrated by Mark Vitor.
Chapter 1. The Plain of Fear. The still desert air had a lens-like quality. The riders seemed frozen in time, moving without drawing closer. We took turns counting. I could not get the same number twice running. A breath of a breeze whined in the coral, stirred the leaves of Old Father Tree. They tinkled off one another with the song of wind chimes. To the north, the glimmer of change lightning limned the horizon like the far clash of warring gods. A foot crunched sand. I turned. Silent gawked at a talking menhir. It had appeared in the past few seconds, startling him. Sneaky rocks. Like to play games.
"There are strangers on the plain," it said.
I jumped. It chuckled. Menhirs have the most malevolent laughs this side of fairy stories. Snarling, I ducked into its shadow. Hot out here already. And that's One Eye and Goblin, back from Tanner. It was right, and I was wrong. I was too narrowly focused. The patrol had been away a month longer than planned. We were worried. Lately, the lady's troops have been more active along the bounds of the Plain of Fear. Another chuckle from the block of stone. It towered over me, 13 feet tall. A middle-sized one. Those over 15 feet seldom move. The riders were closer, yet seemed no nearer. Blame nerves. Times are desperate for the Black Company. We cannot afford casualties. Any man lost would be a friend of many years. I counted again. Seemed right this time, but there was a riderless mount. I shivered despite the heat. They were on the down trail leading to a creek 300 yards from where we watched, concealed within a great reef. The walking trees beside the ford stirred, though the breeze had failed. The riders urged their mounts to hurry. The animals were tired. They were reluctant, though they knew they were almost home. Into the creek. Water splashing. I grinned, pounded silence back. They were all there. Every man, and another. Silent shed his customary cool, returned a smile. Elmo slipped out of the coral and went to meet our brethren. Otto, Silent, and I hurried after him. Behind us, the morning sun was a great seething ball of blood. Men piled off horses, grinning. But they looked bad. Goblin and One Eye, worst of all. But they had come back to territory where their wizard's powers were useless. This near Darling, they are no greater than the rest of us. I glanced back. Darling had come to the head of the tunnel, stood like a phantom in its shadow, all in white. Men hugged men. Then old habit took charge. Everybody pretended it was just another day. "Rough out there?" I asked One Eye. I considered the man accompanying them. He was not familiar. "Yes." The dried-up little black man was more diminished than first I'd thought. "You all right?" "Took an arrow." He rubbed his side. "Flesh wound." From behind One Eye, Goblin squeaked. "They almost got us. Been chasing us a month. We couldn't shake them." "Let's get you down in the hole," I told One Eye. "Not infected. I cleared it. I still want a look." "He has been my assistant since I enlisted as company physician. His judgment is sound, yet health is my responsibility, ultimately." "They were waiting for us, Croker." Darling was gone from the mouth of the tunnel, back to the stomach of our subterranean fastness. The sun remained bloody in the east, legacy of the change storms passing. Something big drifted across its face. Wind whale. "Ambush," I glanced back at the patrol. "Not us specifically. For trouble. They were on the ball." The patrol had had a double mission. To contact our sympathizers in Tanner to find out if the lady's people were coming alive after a long hiatus. And to raid the garrison there in order to prove we could hurt an empire that bestrides half a world. As we passed it, the menhir said,
"There are strangers on the plain, Croker."
Why do these things happen to me? The big stones talk to me more than to anyone else. Twice a charm, I paid attention. For a menhir to repeat itself meant it considered its message critical. The men hunting you, I asked One Eye. He shrugged. They wouldn't give up. What's happening out there? Hiding on the plain, I might as well be buried alive. One Eye's face remained unreadable. Corder will tell it. Corder? That the guy you brought in? I knew the name, though not the man. One of our best informants. Yeah. No good news, eh? No. We slipped into the tunnel, which leads down to our warren, our stinking, moldering, damp, tight little rabbit-hole fortress. It is disgusting, but it is the heart and soul of the new White Rose Rebellion, the new hope, as it is whispered among the captive nations, the joke hope to those of us who live here. It is as bad as any rat-infested dungeon, though a man can leave. If he does not mind a venture into a world where all the might of an empire is turned upon him. Chapter 2 The Plain of Fear. Corder was our eyes and ears in Tanner. He had contacts everywhere. His work against the Lady goes back decades. He is one of the few who escaped her wrath at Charm, where she obliterated the rebel of old. In great part, the company was responsible. In those days, we were her strong right arm. We piloted her enemies into the trap. 250,000 men died at Charm. Never was there a battle so vast or grim, nor an outcome so definitive. Even the Dominator's bloody failure in the Old Forest consumed but half as many lives. Fate compelled us to switch sides, once there was no one left to help us in our fight. One Eye's wound was as clean as he claimed. I cut him loose, ambled off to my quarters. Word was, Darling wanted the patrol rested before she accepted its report. I shivered with premonition, afraid to hear their tidings. An old, tired man, that is what I am. What became of the old fire, drive, ambition? There were dreams once upon a time, dreams now all but forgotten. On sad days I dust them off and fondle them nostalgically, with a patronizing wonder at the naivete of the youth who dreamed them. Old infests my quarters. My great project, 80 pounds of ancient documents captured from the general Whisper when we served the Lady and Whisper the Rebel. They are supposed to contain the key to breaking the Lady and the Taken. I have had them 6 years, and in 6 years I have found nothing. So much failure. Depressing. Nowadays, more often than not, I merely shuffle them, then turn to these annals. Since our escape from Juniper, they have been little more than a personal journal. The remnant of the company generates little excitement. What outside news we get is so slim and unreliable, I seldom bother recording it. Moreover, since her victory over her husband in Juniper, the Lady seems to be in stasis even more than we, running on inertia. Appearances deceive, of course, and the Lady's essence is illusion. Croker. I looked up from a page of old Telcurry, already studied 100 times. Goblin stood in the doorway. He looked like an old toad. Yeah? Something happening up top. Grab a sword. I grabbed my bow and a leather cuirass. I am too ancient for hand to hand. I'd rather stand off and plink if I have to fight at all. I considered the bow as I followed Goblin. It had been given me by the Lady herself during the battle at Charm. Oh, the memories. With it I helped slay Soulcatcher, the Taken who brought the company into the Lady's service. Those days now seemed almost prehistoric. We galloped into sunlight. Others came out with us, dispersed amidst cactus and coral. The rider coming down the trail, the only path in here, would not see us. He rode alone on a moth-eaten mule. He was not armed. All this for an old man on a mule, I asked. Men scooted through coral and between cacti, making one hell of a racket. The old-timer had to know we were there. We'd better work on getting out here more quietly. Yeah. Startled, I whirled. Elmo was behind me, one hand shading his eyes. He looked as old and tired as I felt. Each day something reminds me that none of us are young anymore. Hell, none of us were young when we came north over the Sea of Torments. We need new blood, Elmo. He sneered. Yes, we will be a lot older before this is done, if we last, for we are buying time. Decades, hopefully. The rider crossed the creek, stopped. He raised his hands. Men materialized, weapons held negligently. One old man alone, at the heart of Darling's Null, presented no danger. Elmo, Goblin, and I strolled down. As we went, I asked Goblin, "You and One Eye have fun while you were gone. They have been feuding for ages, but here, where Darling's presence forbids it, they cannot play sorcerous tricks." Goblin grinned. When he grins, his mouth spreads from ear to ear. I loosened him up. We reached the rider. "Tell me later." Goblin giggled, a squeaking noise like water bubbling in a tea kettle. "Yeah." "Who are you?" Elmo asked the mule rider. "Tokens." That was not a name. It was a password for a courier from the far west. We had not heard it for a long time. Western messengers had to reach the plain through the lady's most tamed provinces. "Yeah?" Elmo said. "How about that? Want to step down?" The old man eased off his mount, presented his bona fides. Elmo found them acceptable. Then he announced, "I've got 20 pounds of stuff here." He tapped a case behind his saddle. "Every damn town added to the load." "Make the whole trip yourself?" I asked. "Every foot from Orr." "Orr? That's more than 1,000 miles. I hadn't known we had anyone up there. But there is a lot I do not know about the organization Darling has assembled. I spend my time trying to get those damn papers to tell me something that may not be there." The old man looked at me as though subjecting my soul to an accounting. "You the physician, Croker?" "Yeah, so?" "Got something for you. Personal." He opened his courier case. For a moment everyone was alert. You never know. But he brought out an oilskin packet wrapped to protect something against the end of the world. "Rains all the time up there," he explained. He gave me the packet. I weighed it. Not that heavy, oilskin aside. "Who's it from?" The old man shrugged. "Where'd you get it?" "From my cell, Captain." "Of course. Darling has built with care, structuring her organization so that it is almost impossible for the lady to break more than a fraction. The child is a genius." Elmo accepted the rest, told Otto, "Take him down and find him a bunk. Get some rest, old-timer. The White Rose will question you later." An interesting afternoon upcoming, maybe, what with this guy and Corder both to report. I hefted the mystery packet, told Elmo, "I'll go give this a look." Who could have sent it? I knew no one outside the plane. Well, but the lady would not inject a letter into the underground, would she? Twinge of fear. It had been a while, but she had promised to keep in touch. The talking menhir that had forewarned us about the messenger remained rooted beside the path. As I passed, it said,
"There are strangers on the plain, Croker."
I halted. "What, more of them?" It reverted to character, would say no more. Never will I comprehend those old stones. Hell, I still don't understand why they are on our side. They hate all outsiders separately, but equally. They and every one of the weird sentiences out here. I slipped into my quarters, unstrung my bow, left it leaning against the earth wall. I settled at my work table and opened the packet. I did not recognize the hand. I found the ending was not signed. I began to read. Chapter 3. Story from Yesteryear. Croker. The woman was bitching again. Bowmans massaged his temples. The throbbing did not slacken. He covered his eyes. "Seta, Seta, Suta," he murmured, his sibilance angry and ophidian. He bit his tongue. One did not make ascending upon one's wife. One endured with humble dignity the consequences of youthful folly. Ah, but what temptation! What provocation! Enough, fool. Study the damn chart. Neither Jasmine nor the headache relented. Bloody hell! He slapped the weights off the corners of the chart, rolled the thin silk around a wisp of glass rod. He slipped the rod inside the shaft of a fake antique spear. That shaft was shiny with handling. B-Sand would spot it in a minute, he grumbled. He ground his teeth as his ulcer took a bite of gut. The closer the end drew, the greater was the danger. His nerves were shot. He was afraid he might crack at the last barrier, that cowardice would devour him and he would have lived in vain. 37 years was a long time to live in the shadow of the headsman's axe. Jasmine, he muttered, and call a sow beauty. He flung the door hanging aside, shouted downstairs, "What is it now?" It was what it always was, nagging, unconnected with the root of her dissatisfaction, an interruption of his studies as a payback for what she fancied was his having misspent their lives. He could have become a man of consequence in Orr. He could have given her a great house, overstuffed with fawning servants. He could have draped her in cloth of gold. He could have fed her tumble-down fat with meat at every meal. Instead, he had chosen a scholar's life, disguising his name and profession, dragging her to this bleak, haunted break in the old forest. He had given her nothing but squalor, icy winters, and indignities perpetrated by the Eternal Guard. Bowman's stamped down the narrow, squeaky, treacherous stairway. He cursed the woman, spat on the floor, thrust silver into her desiccated paw, drove her away with a plea that supper, for once, be a decent meal. Indignity, he thought. I'll tell you about indignity, you old crow. I'll tell you what it's like to live with a perpetual whiner, a hideous old bag of vapid, juvenile dreams. Stop it, Bowmans, he muttered. She's the mother of your son. Give her her due. She hasn't betrayed you. If nothing else, they still shared the hope represented by the map on silk. It was hard for her, waiting, unaware of his progress, knowing only that nearly 4 decades had yielded no tangible result. The bell on the shop door tinkled. Bowman's clutched at his shopkeeper persona. He scuttled forward, a fat, bald little man with blue-veined hands folded before his chest. Tokar, he bowed slightly. I didn't expect you so soon. Tokar was a trader from Orr, a friend of Bowman's son, Stancil. He had a bluff, honest, irreverent manner Bowman's deluded himself into seeing as the ghost of his own at a younger age.
Didn't plan to be back so soon, Bo, but antiques are the rage. It surpasses comprehension. You want another lot? Already? You'll clean me out.
Unsaid, the silent complaint. Bowman's, this means replenishment work. Time lost from research.
The domination is hot this year. Stop pottering around, Bo. Make hay and all that. Next year the market could be as dead as the taken.
They're not. Maybe I'm getting too old, Tokar. I don't enjoy the rows with B-Sand anymore. Hell, 10 years ago I went looking for him. A good squabble killed boredom. The digging grinds me down, too. I'm used up. I just want to sit on the stoop and watch life go by. While he chattered, Bowman set out his best antique swords, pieces of armor, soldiers' amulets, and an almost perfectly preserved shield. A box of arrowheads with roses engraved, a pair of broad-bladed thrusting spears, ancient heads mounted on replica shafts.
I can send you some men. Show them where to dig. I'll pay you commission. You won't have to do anything.
That's a damned fine axe, Bo. Tell Curry. I could sell a barge load of Tell Curry weaponry.
Ukiteli, actually.
A twinge from his ulcer. No, no helpers. That was all he needed. A bunch of young hotshots hanging over his shoulder while he made his field calculations. Just a suggestion? Sorry, don't mind me. Jasmine was on me this morning. Softly, Tokar asked, Found anything connected with the Taken? With the ease of decades, Bowman's dissembled, feigning horror. The Taken? Am I a fool? I wouldn't touch it if I could get it past the monitor. Tokar smiled conspiratorily. Sure, we don't want to offend the Eternal Guard. Nevertheless, there's one man in Or who would pay well for something that could be ascribed to one of the Taken. He'd sell his soul for something that belonged to the lady. He's in love with her. She was known for that. Bowman's avoided the younger man's gaze. How much had Stance revealed? Was this one of Bisan's fishing expeditions? The older Bowman's became, the less he enjoyed the game. His nerves could not take this double life. He was tempted to confess just for the relief. No, damn it. He had too much invested. 37 years. Digging and scratching every minute. Sneaking and pretending. The most abject poverty. No. He would not give up. Not now. Not when he was this close. In my way, I love her too, he admitted. But I haven't abandoned good sense. I'd scream for Bisand if I found anything. So loud you'd hear me in awe. All right, whatever you say, Tokar grinned. Enough suspense. He produced a leather wallet. Letters from Stancil. Bowman's seized the wallet. Haven't heard from him since last time you were here. Can I start loading, Bo? Sure, go ahead. Absently, Bowman's took his current inventory list from a pigeonhole. Mark off whatever you take. Tokar laughed gently. All of it this time, Bo. Just quote me a price. Everything? Half is junk. I told you, the domination is hot. You saw Stance. How is he? He was halfway through the first letter. His son had nothing substantial to relate. His missives were filled with daily trivia, duty letters, letters from a son to his parents, unable to span the timeless chasm. Sickeningly healthy. Bored with the university. Read on. There's a surprise. Tokar was here, Bowman said. He grinned, danced from foot to foot.
That thief, Jasmine scowled. Did you remember to get paid?
Her fat, sagging face was set in perpetual disapproval. Generally, her mouth was open in the same vein. He brought letters from Stance. Here. He offered the packet. He could not contain himself. Stance is coming home.
Home? He can't. He has his position at the university.
He's taking a sabbatical. He's coming for the summer.
Why?
To see us. To help with the shop. To get away so he can finish a thesis. Jasmine grumbled. She did not read the letters. She had not forgiven her son for sharing his father's interest in the domination.
What he's doing is coming here to help you poke around where you're not supposed to poke, isn't he?
Bowman's darted furtive glances at the shop's windows. His was an existence of justifiable paranoia. It's the year of the comet. The ghosts of the Taken will rise to mourn the passing of the domination. This summer would mark the 10th return of the comet, which had appeared at the hour of the Dominator's fall. The 10 who were taken would manifest strongly. Bowman's had witnessed one passage the summer he had come to the Old Forest, long before Stancil's birth. The Barrowland had been impressive with ghosts walking. Excitement tightened his belly. Jasmine would not appreciate it, but this was the summer. End of the long quest. He lacked only one key. Find it, and he could make contact, could begin drawing out instead of putting in. Jasmine sneered.
Why did I get into this? My mother warned me.
It's Stancil we're talking about, woman. Our only.
Ah, Beau, don't call me a cruel old lady. Of course I'll welcome him. Don't I cherish him, too?
Wouldn't hurt to show it. Bowman's examined the remnants of his inventory. Nothing left but the worst junk. These old bones ache just thinking of the digging I'll have to do. His bones ached, but his spirit was eager. Restocking was a plausible excuse for wandering the edges of the Barrowland.
No time like now to start.
You trying to get me out of the house? That wouldn't hurt my feelings. Sighing, Bowman surveyed his shop. A few pieces of time-rotted gear, broken weapons, a skull that could not be attributed because it lacked the triangular inset characteristic of domination officers. Collectors were not interested in the bones of Kearns or in those of followers of the White Rose. Curious, he thought. Why are we so intrigued by evil? The White Rose was more heroic than the Dominator or Taken. She has been forgotten by everybody but the Monitor's men. Any peasant can name half the Taken. The Barrowland, where evil lies restless, is guarded, and the grave of the White Rose is lost. Neither here nor there, Bowmans grumbled. Time to hit the field. Here, here, spade, divining wand, bags. Maybe Tokar was right. Maybe I should get a helper. Brushes, help carry that stuff around. Transit, maps, can't forget those. What else? Claim ribbons, of course. That wretched men foo. He stuffed things into a pack and hung equipment all about himself. He gathered spade and rake and transit. Jasmine! Jasmine! Open the damn door! She peeped through the curtains masking their living quarters. Should have opened it first, dimwit. She stalked across the shop. One of these days, Beau, you're going to get organized. Probably the day after my funeral. He stumbled down the street, grumbling. I'll get organized the day you die. Damned well better believe. I want you in the ground before you change your mind.
Chapter 4 The Near Past, Corby. The Barrowland lies far north of Charm, in the old forest so storied in the legends of the White Rose. Corby came to the town there the summer after the Dominator failed to escape his grave through Juniper. He found the lady's minions in high morale. The grand evil in the Great Barrow was no longer to be feared. The dregs of the rebel had been routed. The Empire had no more enemies of consequence. The great comet, harbinger of all catastrophes, would not return for decades. One lone focus of resistance remained— A child claimed to be the reincarnation of the White Rose. But she was a fugitive, running with the remnants of the traitorous Black Company. Nothing to fear there. The lady's overwhelming resources would swamp them. Corby came limping up the road from Orr, alone, a pack on his back, a staff gripped tightly. He claimed to be a disabled veteran of the Limpers Forsberg campaigns. He wanted work. There was work aplenty for a man not too proud. The Eternal Guard were well paid. Many hired drudge work taken off their duties. At that time, a regiment garrisoned the Barrowland. Countless civilians orbited its compound. Corby vanished among those. When companies and battalions transferred out, he was an established part of the landscape. He washed dishes, curried horses, cleaned stables, carried messages, mopped floors, peeled vegetables, assumed any burden for which he might earn a few coppers. He was a quiet, tall, dusky, brooding sort, who made no special friends, but made no enemies either. Seldom did he socialize. After a few months, he asked for and received permission to occupy a ramshackle house, long shunned because once it belonged to a sorcerer from Orr. As time and resources permitted, he restored the place— and like the sorcerer before him, he pursued the mission that had brought him north. 10, 12, 14 hours a day, Corby worked around town, then went home and worked some more. People wondered when he rested. If there was anything that detracted from Corby, it was that he refused to assume his role completely. Most scut boys had to endure a lot of personal abuse. Corby would not accept it. Victimize him, and his eyes went cold as winter steel. Only one man ever pressed Corby once he got that look. Corby beat him with ruthless, relentless efficiency. No one suspected him of leading a double life. Outside his home he was Corby the Swamper, nothing more. He lived the role to his heart. When he was home, in the more public hours, he was Corby the Renovator, creating a new home from an old—
Only in the wee hours, while all but the night patrol slept, did he become Corby the Man with a Mission. Corby the Renovator found a treasure in a wall of the wizard's kitchen. He took it upstairs, where Corby the Driven came up from the deeps. The scrap of paper bore a dozen words scribbled in a shaky hand. A cipher key. That lean, dusky, long, unsmiling face shed its ice. Dark eyes sparkled, fingers turned up a lamp. Corby sat, and for an hour stared at nothing. Then, still smiling, he went downstairs and out into the night. He raised a hand in gentle greeting whenever he encountered the night patrol. He was known now. No one challenged his right to limp about and watch the constellations wheel. He went home when his nerves settled. There would be no sleep for him. He scattered papers, began to study, to decipher, to translate, to write a story letter that would not reach its destination for years. Chapter 5. The Plane of Fear. One Eye stopped by to tell me Darling was about to interview Corder and the messenger. "She's looking peaked, Croker. You've been watching her." "I watch. I advise. She ignores. What can I do?" "We got 20-some years till the comet shows. No point her working herself to death, is there?" "Tell her that. She just tells me this mess will be settled long before the comet comes around again, that it's a race against time." "She believes that, but the rest of us cannot catch her fire. Isolated in the plane of fear, cut off from the world, we find the struggle with the lady sometimes slips in importance. The plane itself too often preoccupies us." I caught myself outdistancing One Eye. This premature burial has not been good for him. Without his skills, he has weakened physically. He's beginning to show his age. I let him catch up. "You and Goblin enjoy your adventure." He could not choose between a smirk or a scowl. "Got you again, eh?" "Their battle has been on since the dawn. One Eye starts each skirmish. Goblin usually finishes." He grumbled something. "What?" "Yo!" someone shouted. "Everybody up top! Alert! Alert!" One Eye spat. "Twice in one day? What the hell?" I knew what he meant. We have not had 20 alerts our whole 2 years out here. Now 2 in one day? Improbable. I dashed back for my bow. This time we went out with less clatter. Elmo had made his displeasure painfully apparent in a few private conversations. Sunlight again, like a blow. The entrance to the hole faces westward. The sun was in our eyes when we emerged. "You damned fool!" Elmo was yelling. "What the hell you doing?" A young soldier stood in the open, pointing. I let my gaze follow. "Oh, damn," I whispered. "Oh, double bloody damn." One Eye saw it, too. "Taken." The airborne dot drifted higher, circling our hideout, spiraling inward. It wobbled suddenly. "Yeah, taken. Whisper or journey?" "Good to see old friends," Goblin said as he joined us. We had not seen the Taken since reaching the plane. Before that, they had been in our hair constantly, having pursued us all the 4 years it had taken us to get here from Juniper. They are the lady's satraps, her understudies in terror. Once there were 10. In the time of the domination, the lady and her husband enslaved the greatest of their contemporaries, making them their instruments, the 10 who were taken. The Taken went into the ground with their masters when the White Rose defeated the Dominator 4 centuries ago, and they arose with the Lady 2 turns of the comet back. And in fighting among themselves, for some remained loyal to the Dominator, most perished. But the Lady obtained new slaves. Feather. Whisper. Journey. Feather and the last of the old ones, the Limper, went down at Juniper when we overcame the Dominator's bid for his own resurrection. 2 are left. Whisper. Journey. The flying carpet wobbled because it had reached the boundary where Darling's null was enough to overpower its buoyancy. The Taken turned away, falling outward, got far enough to recover complete control. "Pity it didn't come straight in," I said, "and come down like a rock." "They're not stupid," Goblin said. "They're just scouting us now." He shook his head, shuddered. He knew something I did not, probably something learned during his venture outside the plane. "Campaign heating up?" I asked.
"Yep." "What are you doing, Bat Breath?" he snapped at One Eye. "Pay attention."
The little black man was ignoring the Taken. He stared at the wild, wind-carved bluffs south of us.
"Our job is to stay alive," One Eye said,
so smug you knew he had something to get Goblin's goat. "That means don't get distracted by the first flashy show you see." "What the hell does that mean?"
"Means while the rest of you are eyeballing that clown up there, another one sneaked up behind the bluffs and put somebody down."
Goblin and I glared at the red cliffs. We saw nothing.
"Too late," One Eye said. "It's gone. But I reckon somebody should go collect the spy."
I believed One Eye. "Elmo, get over here," I explained.
"Beginning to move," he murmured. "Just when I was hoping they'd forgotten us."
"Oh, they haven't," Goblin said.
"They most certainly haven't."
Again, I felt he had something on his mind. Elmo scanned the ground between us and the bluffs. He knew it well. We all do. One day our lives may depend on our knowing it better than someone hunting us.
"Okay," he told himself. "I see it. I'll take 4 men, after I see the lieutenant."
The lieutenant does not come up for alerts. He and 2 other men camp in the doorway to Darling's quarters. If ever the enemy reaches Darling, it will be over their bodies. The flying carpet went away westward. I wondered why it had gone unchallenged by the creatures of the plain. I went to the menhir that had spoken to me earlier. I asked. Instead of answering, it said,
"It begins, Croker. Mark this day."
"Yeah, right. And I do call that day the beginning, though parts of it started years before. That was the day of the first letter, the day of the Taken, and the day of Tracker and Toad Killer Dog." The men here had a final remark.
"There are strangers on the plane."
It would not defend the various flyers for not resisting the Taken. Elmo returned. I said, "The men here says we might have more visitors." Elmo raised an eyebrow.
"You and Silent have the next 2 watches."
"Yep."
"Be careful. Goblin, One Eye, come here."
They put their heads together. Then Elmo picked 4 youngsters and went hunting. Chapter 6 The Plane of Fear. I went up top for my watch. There was no sign of Elmo and his men. The sun was low. The menhir was gone. There was no sound but the voice of the wind. Silent sat in shadow inside a reef of 1,000 coral, dappled by sunlight come through twisted branches. Coral makes good cover. Few of the plain's denizens dare its poisons. The watch is always in more danger from native exotica than from our enemies. I twisted and ducked between deadly spines, joined Silent. He is a long, lean, aging man. His dark eyes seemed focus on dreams that had died. I deposited my weapons. "Anything?" He shook his head, a single minuscule negative. I arranged the pads I had brought. The coral twisted around us, branches and fans climbing 20 feet high. We could see little but the creek crossing and a few dead menhirs and the walking trees on the far slope. One tree stood beside the brook, taproot in the water. As though sensing my attention, it began a slow retreat. The visible plain is barren. The usual desert life, lichens and scrub brush, snakes and lizards, scorpions and spiders, wild dogs and ground squirrels, is present but scarce. You encounter it mainly when that is inconvenient, which sums up plain life generally. You encounter the real strangeness only when that is most inopportune. The lieutenant claims a man trying to commit suicide here could spend years without becoming uncomfortable. The predominant colors are reds and browns, rust, ochre, blood and wine-shaded sandstones like the bluffs, with here and there the random stratum of orange. The corals lay down scattered white and pink reefs. True verdance is absent. Both walking trees and scrub plants have leaves a dusty gray-green, in which green exists mainly by acclimation. The menhirs, living and dead, are a stark gray-brown, unlike any stone native to the plain. A bloated shadow drifted across the wild scree skirting the cliffs. It covered many acres, was too dark to be the shadow of a cloud. Windwhale, Silent nodded. It cruised the upper air between us and the sun, but I could not spot it. I had not seen one in years. Last time Elmo and I were crossing the plain with Whisper on the lady's behalf, that long ago. Time does flee, and with little fun in it. Strange waters under the bridge, my friend. Strange waters under. He nodded, but he did not speak. He is silent. He has not spoken in all the years I have known him, nor in the years he has been with the company. Yet both One Eye and my predecessor as analyst say he is quite capable of speech. From hints accumulated over the years, it has become my firm conviction that in his youth, before he signed on, he swore a great oath never to speak. It being the iron law of the company not to pry into a man's life before he enlisted, I have been unable to learn anything about the circumstances. I have seen him come close to speaking when he was angry enough or amused enough, but he always caught himself at the last instant. For a long time, men made a game of baiting him, trying to get him to break his vow, but most abandoned the effort quickly. Silent had 100 little ways of discouraging a man, like filling his bedroll with ticks. Shadows lengthened, stains of darkness spread. At last Silent rose, stepped over me, returned to the hole, a darkly clad shadow moving through darkness. A strange man, Silent. Not only does he not talk, he does not gossip. How can you get a handle on a guy like that? Yet he is one of my oldest and closest friends. Go explain that.
"Well, Croaker?"
The voice was as hollow as a ghost's. I started. Malicious laughter rattled through the coral reef. A menhir had slipped up on me. I turned slightly. It stood square on the path Silent had taken, 12 feet tall and ugly. A runt of its kind. "Hello, Rock." Having amused itself at my expense, it now ignored me. Stayed as silent as a stone. Ha ha. The menhirs are our principal allies upon the plain. They interlocute for the other sentient species. They let us know what is happening only when it suits them, however. "What's happening with Elmo?" I asked. "Nothing." "Are they magic?" "I guess not. Otherwise they would not survive inside the nullity Darling radiates." "But what are they?" "Mysteries, like most of the bizarre creatures out here."
"There are strangers on the plain."
"I know, I know." Night creatures came out. Dots of luminescence fluttered and swooped above. The windwhale, whose shadow I saw, came far enough eastward to show me its glimmering underbelly. It would descend soon, trailing tendrils to trap whatever came its way. A breeze rose. Sagey scents trickled across my nostrils. Air chuckled and whispered and murmured and whistled in the coral. From farther away came the wind chimes tinkle of old Father Tree. He is unique. First or last of his kind, I do not know. There he stands, 20 feet tall and 10 thick, brooding beside the creek, radiating something akin to dread, his roots planted on the geographical center of the plain. Silent, Goblin, and One Eye have all tried to unravel his significance. They have gotten nowhere. The scarce wild human tribesmen of the plain worship him. They say he has been here since the dawn. He does have that timeless feel. The moon rose. While it lay torpid and pregnant on the horizon, I thought I saw something cross it. Taken? Or one of the plain creatures? A racket rose around the mouth of the hole. I groaned. I did not need this. Goblin and One-Eye. For half a minute, uncharitably, I wished they had not come back. Knock it off. I don't want to hear that crap. Goblin scooted up outside the coral, grinned, dared me to do something. He looked rested, recuperated. One-Eye asked, "Feeling cranky, Croaker?" "Damn straight. What are you doing out here?" "Needed some fresh air." He cocked his head, stared at the line of cliffs. "So, worried about Elmo?" "He'll be all right," I said. "I know," One-Eye added. "I lied. Darling sent us. She felt something stir at the western edge of the null." "Ah? I don't know what it was, Croaker." Suddenly he was defensive, pained. He would have known but for Darling. He stands where I would were I stripped of my medical gear, helpless to do what he has trained at all his life. "What are you going to do?" "Build a fire."
"What?"
That fire roared. One-Eye got so ambitious he dragged in enough deadwood to serve half a legion. The flames beat back the darkness till I could see 50 yards beyond the creek. The last walking trees had departed, probably smelled One-Eye coming. He and Goblin dragged in a fallen tree of the ordinary sort. We leave the walkers alone, except to right clumsies that trip on their own roots. Not that that happens often. They do not travel much. They were bickering about who was dogging his share of work. They dropped the tree. "Fade," Goblin said, and in a moment there was no sign of them. Baffled, I surveyed the darkness. I saw nothing, heard nothing. I found myself having trouble remaining awake. I broke up the dead tree for something to do. Then I felt the oddness. I stopped in mid-break. How long had the menhirs been gathering? I counted 14 on the verges of the light. They cast long, deep shadows. "What's up?" I asked, my nerves a bit frayed.
"There are strangers on the plain."
Hell of a tune they played. I settled near the fire, back to it, tossed wood over my shoulder, building the flames. The light spread. I counted another 10 menhirs. After a time, I said, "That's not exactly news."
"One comes."
That was new, and spoken with passion, something I had not witnessed before. Once, twice, I thought I caught a flicker of motion, but I could not be sure. Firelight is tricky. I piled on more wood. Movement for sure. Beyond the creek. Man-shape coming toward me, slowly. Wearily, I settled in pretended boredom. He came nearer. Across his right shoulder he carried a saddle and blanket held with his left hand. In his right, he carried a long wooden case, its polish gleaming in the firelight. It was 7 feet long and 4 inches by 8. Curious. I noticed the dog as they crossed the creek. A mongrel, ragged, mangy, mostly a dirty white, but with a black circle around one eye and a few daubs of black on its flanks. It limped, carrying one forepaw off the ground. The fire caught its eyes. They burned bright red. The man was over 6 feet, maybe 30. He moved lively even in his weariness. He had muscles on muscles. His tattered shirt revealed arms and chest crisscrossed with scars. His face was empty of emotion. He met my gaze as he approached the fire, neither smiling nor betraying unfriendly intent. Chill touched me lightly. He looked tough, but not tough enough to negotiate the plane of fear alone. First order of business would be to stall. Otto was due out to relieve me soon. The fire would alert him. He would see the stranger, then duck down and rouse the hole. "Hello," I said. He halted, exchanged glances with his mongrel. The dog came forward slowly, sniffing the air, searching the surrounding night. It stopped a few feet away, shook as though wet, settled on its belly. The stranger came forward just that far. "Take a load off," I invited. He swung his saddle down, lowered his case, sat. He was stiff. He had trouble crossing his legs. "Lose your horse." He nodded. Broke a leg. West of here. 5-6 miles. I lost the trail. There are trails through the plain. Some of them the plain honors as safe. Sometimes. According to a formula known only to its denizens, only someone desperate or stupid hazards them alone, though. This fellow did not look like an idiot. The dog made a woofling sound. The man scratched its ears. "Where are you headed?"
"Place called the Fastness."
That is the legend name, the propaganda name, for the hole. A calculated bit of glamour for the troops in faraway places.
"Name?"
"Tracker. This is Toad Killer Dog."
"Pleased to meet you, Tracker."
"Toad Killer?" The dog grumbled. Tracker said, "You have to use his whole name, Toad Killer Dog." I kept a straight face only because he was such a big, grim, tough-looking man. "What's this Fastness?" I asked. "I never heard of it." He lifted hard, dark eyes from the mutt, smiled. "I've heard it lies near Tokens." "Twice in one day. Was it the day of twos?" "No, not bloody likely." I did not like the look of the man, either. Reminded me too much of our one-time brother, Raven. Ice and iron. I donned my baffled face. It is a good one. "Tokens. That's a new one on me. Must be somewhere way the hell out east. What are you headed there for, anyway?" He smiled again. His dog opened one eye, gave me a baleful look. They did not believe me.
"Carrying messages."
"I see. Mainly a packet, addressed to somebody named Croaker." I sucked spittle between teeth, slowly scanned the surrounding darkness. The circle of light had shrunk, but the number of menhirs remained undiminished. I wondered about One Eye and Goblin. "Now there's a name I've heard," I said. "Some kind of sawbones." Again the dog gave me that look. This time I decided it was sarcastic. One Eye stepped out of the darkness behind Tracker, sword ready to do the dirty deed. Damn, but he came quiet, witchery or no. I gave him away with a flicker of surprise. Tracker and his dog looked back. Both were startled to see someone there. The dog rose, its hackles lifted. Then it sank to the ground again, having twisted till it could keep us both in sight. But then Goblin appeared, just as quietly. I smiled. Tracker glanced over. His eyes narrowed. He looked thoughtful, like a man discovering he was in a card game with rogues sharper than he had expected. Goblin chuckled.
"He wants in, Croaker. I say we take him down."
Tracker's hand twitched toward the case he had carried. His animal growled. Tracker closed his eyes. When they opened, he was in control. His smile returned.
"Croaker, eh? Then I've found the Fastness."
"You found it, friend." Slowly, so as not to alarm anyone, Tracker took an oilskin packet from his saddlebag. It was the twin of that I had received only half a day before. He offered it to me. I tucked it inside my shirt.
"Where'd you get it?"
"Or?" He told the same story as the other messenger. I nodded.
"You've come that far, then?"
"Yes."
"We should take him in, then," I told One Eye.
He caught my meaning. We would let this messenger come face to face with the other, see if sparks flew. One Eye grinned. I glanced at Goblin. He approved. None of us felt quite right about Tracker. I'm not sure why.
"Let's go," I said. I hoisted myself off the ground with my bow.
Tracker eyed the stave. He started to say something, shut up, as though he recognized it. I smiled as I turned away. Maybe he thought he had fallen foul of the lady.
"Follow me."
He did, and Goblin and One Eye followed him, neither helping with his gear. His dog limped beside him, nose to the ground. Before we went inside, I glanced southward, concerned. When would Elmo come home? We put Tracker and Mutt into a guarded cell. They did not protest. I went to my quarters after wakening Otto, who was overdue. I tried to sleep, but that damned packet lay on the table, screaming. I was not sure I wanted to read its contents. It won the battle. Chapter 7 The Second Letter. Croker. Bowmans peered through his transit, sighting on the prow of the great barrow. He stepped back, noted the angle, opened one of his crude field maps. This was where he had unearthed the Telcurry axe. Wish Oculus descriptions weren't so vague. This must have been the flank of their formation. The axis of their line should have paralleled the others, so. Shifter and the knights would have bunched up over there. I'll be damned. The ground there humped slightly. Good. Less groundwater to damage buried artifacts. But the overgrowth was dense. Scrub oak, wild roses, poison ivy. Especially poison ivy. Bowmans hated that pestilential weed. He started scratching just thinking about it. Bowmans? What? He whirled, raising his rake. Whoa, take it easy, Bow. What's the matter with you, sneaking up like that? Ain't funny, Bisand. Want me to rake that idiot grin off your face? Ooh, nasty today, aren't we? Bisand was a lean old man, approximately Bowman's age. His shoulders slumped, following his head, which thrust forward as though he was sniffing a trail. Great blue veins humped the backs of his hands. Liver spots dotted his skin. What the hell do you expect? Come jumping out of the bushes at a man? Bushes? What bushes? Your conscience bothering you, Beau. Bisand, you've been trying to trap me since the moon was green. Why don't you give up? First Jasmine gives me a hard way to go, then Tokar buys me out so I have to go digging fresh stock, and now I have to dance with you. Go away. I'm not in the mood. Bisand grinned a big, lopsided grin, revealing pickets of rotten teeth. I haven't caught you, Bo, but that don't mean you're innocent. It just means I never caught you. If I'm not innocent, you must be damned stupid not to catch me in 40 years. Damn, man, why the hell can't you make life easy for both of us? Bisand laughed. Real soon now I'll be out of your hair for good. They're putting me out to pasture. Bowmans leaned on his rake, considered the guardsman. Bisand exuded a sour odor of pain. Really? I'm sorry. Bet you are. My replacement might be smart enough to catch you. Give it a rest. You want to know what I'm doing? Figuring where the Telcurry knights went down. Tokar wants spectacular stuff. That's the best I can do, short of going over there and giving you an excuse to hang me. Hand me that dowser. Bisand passed the divining rod. Mound robbing, eh? Tokar suggest that. Icy needles burrowed into Bowman's spine. This was more than a casual question. We have to do this constantly. Haven't we known each other long enough to do without the cat and mouse? I enjoy it, Bo. Bisand trailed him to the overgrown hummock. Going to have to clear this out. Just can't keep up any more. Not enough men, not enough money. Could you get it right away? That's where I want to dig, I think. Poison ivy. Oh, where poison ivy, Bo? Bisand snickered. Each summer, Bowmans cursed his way through numerous botanical afflictions. About Tokar. I don't deal with people who want to break the law. That's been my rule forever. Nobody bothers me any more. Oblique, but acceptable. Bowmans's wand twitched. I'll be dipped in sheep shit, right in the middle. Sure. Look at it jump. Must have buried them in one big hole. About Tokar. What about him, dammit? You want to hang him? Go ahead. Just give me time to hook up with somebody else who can handle my business as good. I don't want to hang anybody, Bo. I just want to warn you. There's a rumor out of Orr that says he's a resurrectionist. Bowmans dropped his rod. He gobbled air. Really? A resurrectionist? The monitor scrutinized him intently. Just a rumor? I hear all kinds. Thought you might want to know. We're as close as two men get around here. Bowmans accepted the olive branch. Yeah, Honestly, he's never dropped a hint. Phew, that's a load to drop on a man. A load which deserved some heavy thinking. Don't tell anybody what I found. That thief Men Fu, Bisand laughed yet again. His mirth had a sepulchral quality. You enjoy your work, don't you? I mean, harassing people who don't dare fight back. Careful, Bo. I could drag you in for questioning. Bisand spun, stalked away. Bowman sneered at his back. Of course Bisand enjoyed his job. It let him play dictator. He could do anything to anyone without having to answer for it. Once the Dominator and his minions fell and were buried in their mounds behind barriers wrought of the finest magics of their day, the White Rose decreed that an eternal guard be posted, a guard beholden to none, charged with preventing the resurrection of the undead evil beneath the mounds. The White Rose understood human nature. Always there would be those who would see profit in using or following the Dominator. Always there would be worshippers of evil who wished their champion freed. The resurrectionists appeared almost before the grass sprouted on the barrows. Tokar, a resurrectionist, Bowman's thought. Don't I have enough trouble? Bisand will pitch his tent in my pocket now. Bowman's had no interest in reviving the old evils. He merely wanted to make contact with one of them so as to illuminate several ancient mysteries. Bisand was out of sight. He should stomp all the way back to his quarters. There would be time for a few forbidden observations. Bowman's realigned his transit. The Barrowland did not have the look of great evil, only of neglect. 400 years of vegetation and weather had restructured that once marvelous work. The barrows and mystical landscaping were all but lost amidst the brush covering them. The Eternal Guard no longer had the wherewithal to perform adequate upkeep. Monitor Bisand was fighting a desperate rearguard action against time itself. Nothing grew well on the Barrowland. The vegetation was twisted and stunted. Still, the shapes of the mounds and the menhirs and fetishes which bound the Taken were often concealed. Bowman's had spent a lifetime sorting out which mound was which, who lay where, and where each menhir and fetish stood. His master chart, his silken treasure, was nearly complete. He could almost thread the maze. He was so close, he was tempted to try before he was truly ready. But he was no fool. He meant to try nursing sweet milk from the blackest of cows. He dared make no mistake. He had Bisand on the one hand, the poisonous old wickedness on the other. But if he succeeded, ah, if he succeeded, if he made contact and nursed away the secrets, man's knowledge would be extended dramatically. He would become the mightiest of living mages. His fame would course with the wind. Jasmine would have everything she quarreled about sacrificing. If he made contact. He would, by damn. Neither fear nor the infirmity of age would stay him now. A few months, and he would have the last key. Bowman's had lived his lies so long, he often lied to himself. Even in his honest moments, he never confessed his most powerful motive, his intellectual affair with the lady. It was she who had intrigued him from the beginning, she whom he was trying